City Talk 105.9 official podcasts online at citytalk.fm. The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Thanks for downloading Dino's Starcast. Your chance to hear again some of my exclusive showbiz interviews. Coming up, I'm talking exclusively with Lightning Seeds frontman Ian Brodie. The singing legend that is Engelbert Humperdinck is going to be joining me, and footballing sensation and legend in his own right, Bruce Grobbelaar. That's all coming up on Dino's Starcast. On The Sullivan Show, all the big names in showbiz drop into the cafe for a chat with me. Let's hear a few of them now. Joining me now is Barbara Dixon. Good afternoon, Barbara.
Hello, how are you, Dean?
Very well indeed. Is the sun shining where you are?
Yes, it's lovely. And how is lovely Liverpool?
Liverpool is great. I'm looking forward to greeting you once again. Joining me now in the City Cafe is Joe Swash. How are you, Joe?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you, mate?
Yvette, you're down at St George's Hall. What's going on down there?
Lots of strange stuff, I have to say. Lots of spooky things.
I'm joined by Claire Grogan. Good afternoon, Claire.
Hello.
Well, someone doing his bit is my old mate, Keith Chegwin, and he joins me now in the cafe. How are you, Keith?
Oh, I'm all right, Dean, and you?
Yeah, very well.
Actually, I'm not very well.
Why?
No, I went to the doctor, I had a lettuce growing out my bottom. The doctor said, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Why?
Good afternoon to Lee Mead.
Good to see you.
How are you?
I'm very well.
She is, of course, Caprice.
Hi, how are you?
Good, very well, thank you. All the better for talking to you. Paul Young joins me on the line now. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
Nick Kershaw, he joins me on the line into the cafe now. Good afternoon, Nick.
Good afternoon, Dean.
Of course, it's none other than Kim Wilde. How are we, Kim?
Yeah, great, thank you.
Yeah, looking forward to coming to Liverpool?
Oh, always looking forward to coming to Liverpool, yeah.
Respective, not only my boxing victories, it's the way you carry yourself, because no matter how good you are at what you do, if you don't carry yourself correctly as a man or as a person...
Chris, I'm just wondering, how was that charm demonstrated when you were actually in the boxing ring then?
In the boxing ring?
I mean, a lot of people seeing you, punching someone's head.
Hold on. In the boxing ring, the objective is to score points by striking your opponent. There wasn't ever any anger, malice, hate or dislike involved. It was about scoring points.
Oh, it's Rick Astley. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
Joined now by Jason Isaacs. Good afternoon, Jason.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Very well indeed. Of course, you hail from these shores, don't you?
I do. If I'm not very careful, I'll slip back into my Scouse accent.
When I did a show called Celebrity, Are You Smarter Than 10-Year-Old, I got to the 250,000 level, and they said, do you want to give £100,000 to them, or do you want to take a gamble, and you can have the 250,000, or you go back to £100? Mm. And I thought, I got to help this foundation, because Reese Jones, it's so sad to see a little kid lose their life so foolishly, who deserved to be put in jail for life. But anyway, I gave £100,000, and it's building half of the whole Reese Jones theatrical center and education center.
And then how long were you involved with Dynasty, or Dynasty, as it's alternatively called?
I know, it's tricky, isn't it? I never know which one to say. I did 2 years on Dynasty, then I did a year on Colby's, and then I did another year back on Dynasty.
Did you ever get a say in what you did or didn't wear on the show?
Yes, I mean, they would never put you in something if you hated it. And for example, if there was going to be a big party on the show, then Joan and Linda would sort of bagsy a colour, as it were, and I would bagsy a style. I used to like their strapless, which actually has aged as a style much better than some of the other creations that they came up with. So in retrospect, I think that was a good move.
But I just want to say now, while we're live, thanks very much to everybody who voted for me in Liverpool. Everybody knows I miss Liverpool.
We were flying the flag for you, Ray. We were all here at the top of the tower saying that. I said it from the beginning. I said, Ray Quinn's going to win that competition. What is it about, something like Young Hearts? Where did that song come from?
You know what? That song came from an experience. I was going through some very difficult times. I had a husband. I made a wrong choice selecting a husband, and he was more of like a pimp, he was just not a real good person, and I was trying to get away from him, and I would talk to David a lot about it, and when we came into the session, he brought out Young Hearts Run Free, and I was absolutely just, oh man, I was floored, because the music was so pretty. I'd never heard anything like that. No one had ever done a track like that for me.
Talking to William King of Commodore's fame, was he always the lead singer, or did you take it in turns to do lead vocals?
No, as a matter of fact, when we first got together, Richard didn't sing at all.
Nice.
There were other guys that were singing. He wasn't a singer in the least. He played saxophone, and I played trumpet and keyboards. He played saxophone and keyboards, and Tommy played guitar, and And we were actually a band. We started out without anyone singing. We just played music. We played for a lot of beer blasts for colleges. And
my special guest in the cafe, Freeman of Liverpool, to be made, Freeman of Liverpool, Jerry Marsden. What was it like back in those days, starting out, Jerry?
Very heady. Oh, we started out with hard graft.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't really know what was happening. Brian Epstein made the whole thing change when we came back from Germany. Brian had just signed the Beatles, and he said, Jerry, I'll manage you. And we I knew Brian as a record seller, not as a manager. And I said, OK, Brian. And that just meant giving him the diary, and he'd get an extra £5 a night. And that's how it started. And then suddenly we had the records. And, bloody hell, what's all this? Number one records. Just four kids from Liverpool. And then it was just hectic all over the world. Crazy, as I say, the state thing of Oregon. Everywhere you did. And everybody knew the songs. And we just, it was very, very hard work, but we were young. We were kids, we could handle it.
Brett, of course, it did. It ran for about, was it about five or six years?
We started in 1985 and we finished in 91. So it's over a six-year period, and then they repeated everything.
You know, were you surprised at sort of, because it was hugely popular, wasn't it? Did that take you by surprise?
Yes, it did, rather, because first of all, the critics weren't very kind about it ever. But the public also, in Liverpool particularly, were a bit suspicious about us and thought we were giving them a bad name. And in fact, one guy refused to take me on when we came up filming to the hotel. He said, hey, you're giving us a bad name. And I said, oh, come on, it's not only about Liverpool. I said, did you enjoy Boys from the Black stuff? Oh, yeah, that was a great show. I said, well, this is the comedy version.
That's a good way of putting it, Gene. I like that.
Are you ready for prizes? You shout in one.
In one?
You can hear it here, you can hear it there, you can hear it anywhere with this wonderful Walkman. Gone two.
In two.
That snap will be a snip with this lightweight portable camera.
In three.
When those Crocs are all greasy, life will be easy. with this dishy dishwasher.
In four.
When the weather's trying, you can still be drying with this terrific tumble dryer.
In five.
God, I'm fed up now.
Oh, yeah, well, I think we all are.
The Sullivan Show.
Weekday afternoons, 1 till 4.
On City Talk 105.9.
You're listening to City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. I'm with Ian Brodie, Lightning Seeds, new album, Ian.
Yeah, yeah, quite exciting. First one for ages, really, you know.
Long time in the making.
Kind of a long time wondering if I wanted to make another one. You know, I kind of, because I'd made quite, I think there's a certain point when you have a couple of hits and that, and you get on a bit of a treadmill and you're just touring and making an album and it's kind of going backwards and forwards. And I think I just got to the point where I'd got to the end of my steam a little bit, you know. It's kind of like, I just don't want to do another record. But then, you know, I think when you're a songwriter, I mean, for me it's quite good because I produce bands as well, so that's kind of, I can go off and do that. But you're always writing, and there's always, you know, and then you get a load of songs and you think, oh, I'd love people to hear these songs, and then you find yourself, you know, making a record, which is...
So what inspired you this time round?
I think just, you know, you kind of, I always set off trying to write certain type of songs or trying to write certain things, and I end up nowhere near what I set off to do, if you know what I mean. So I ended up just absolutely nowhere, it isn't anything like I thought it was going to be. And I think that's just the thing, what comes out, and it's sort of, I think when you've got a song and it's, and you think it's a good song, it kind of tends to boss you around a bit, tends to tell you how it's going to go, so you try things on it and it doesn't work, it kicks them out, and then it ends up however it's going to end up, you know. So so I take no responsibility.
What comes first, and the music or the words?
For me, I always find the words quite hard to write, actually. So I don't write on instruments. I kind of just come up with melodies and sing them into my phone or whatever, and chat to myself about what I think it should sound like, and it's like, then it takes me about a year to decipher what I've been saying, because I'm trying to figure out what I was on about. And it's, I suppose, in a way, it's almost like a way of, I think when you write something, the hardest page is page one, So it's, I think you sort of try and trick yourself into page two and miss out page, so you're kind of already going. Because it's that moment when you write, isn't it, where it's not written, and then all of a sudden it's written. And it's almost like in your head, that moment, you're almost pretending it is written and you sing it, or whatever. So it's, I think I've become good at cheating that little moment, you know. And, you know, so I start off with the melodies and then everything. I try and just figure out what feeling that melody's got and take it out around that, you know.
Writing songs, though, does it come from your own personal experience? Are you trying to lay down what you've gone through or what's happened to you or what you're feeling?
I think you're always, when you're writing words, you know, they're always about stuff. And for me, I never sort of, I don't really sit and pick a subject and write about that. Tend to be a bit like, it's just quite free association, and you're writing stuff and then you figure out what it's about and then you order it and stuff. So yeah, I think everything I've ever written has always been, even when I've tried not to, it's always been about myself, really, I think, you know. So, and this album's quite a sort of, you know, some, it's quite introspective in some ways, and it's, you know, there's a sort of, with me, you know, there's the musician, the producer and the songwriter all fighting to get their bit in sometimes, you know. And I think this is probably the best balance of things. I think in the past, you know, you write, sometimes the words are the hardest thing to kind of, you know, look someone in the eye and sing the words. And so I can sometimes swamp that in the production or put a lot of distractions on things. Mm. And I think I haven't done that on this record. I've tried to keep it more like a songwriter's album, you know.
So what are you trying to say this time round?
I don't know what I'm not really, it's not like, you know, it's not like Bob Dylan, it's not a protest album, it's not, you know. But I think it's just, it's probably just about growing older, actually, a lot, really, and just stuff happens to you and it changes the way you write, changes the way even your voice sounds. Actually, I went to see Bob Dylan about 2 nights ago, and it's weird how much his voice has changed. It's like, you know, it's like a different fella. And I suppose, you know, he's 70 or whatever, you know, and you want him to be the young protest singer, you know, but that, you know, and it, I mean, not comparing
myself. So is he still relevant then?
Well, I was going to say, and I think he is relevant, but in a different, he's a different fella to the one, you know, who's singing Blowing in the Wind with an acoustic guitar, you know, in the early 60s, because the world's different and he's different. But actually, when he does his new stuff, it's more relevant in a Willie Dixon kind of way or something like that. You know, it's like a different thing. And I think that's the thing is, as you get older, it's like if you're a painter, you just go through different things. Because music's such a mixture of kind of fashion trends and stuff like that. But if you decide, well, this is what I'm going to do all my life, this is what I do, not much good at anything else, so I do this. It's almost like you've got to musically dress your age in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and that's quite a, I think that's quite a challenge in a way, you know, to do stuff that you're comfortable with but you feel at the same time is relevant, still got that spark of energy that creativity has, and not be a goldfish swimming around in circles, you know.
So where were you when you first started off then, and how are you different now?
I think you know, I suppose you've got something to prove when you first. I mean, when I first started, the last track on my album is called "I Still Feel the Same," and it's about growing up in Liverpool, really, 77 punk rock, you know, and that's really where, you know, I kind of wandered into town when I was 15, 16, down to Matthew Street, which at that time, you know, it was this really weird street because it's kind of steeped in the 60s Merseybeat legend. Mm. But at the same time, it was the sad, sucking 70s, and it was kind of cobbled streets, empty coffee warehouses, waste ground where the cavern was, rubble and stuff, you know. So it was like this kind of almost like sleeping giant, broken kind of thing. I had a lot of, there was an emotional feeling around that area, you know.
And what did it mean to you?
Well, that's, you know, I sort of wandered in there and saw this sign that said the Liverpool School of Music, Dream, Art and Pun, which was this warehouse that someone had set up there. And I went in there and met all these people who were into music, and Probe Records was round the corner, and that became like my sort of mecca, I think. You know, I used to trek down there every day, get the bus in, and hang around there till...
How old were you then?
Probably 17, 16, 17, you know. And, you know, and that kind of... I knew, you know, I wanted to be in a band from that point. And then, you know, punk rock was just starting, little clubs. So then bands were playing in that street. You could see, you know, the bands you were reading about in the NME would be playing in that street. And it was just, that was the centre of my world for a guy called Roger Eagle, who had a, you know, he was a legendary kind of bloke. He used to, big guy, you know, and he used to, that was his empire. He used to stride up and down it. And he had this fantastic record collection from, like, late 50s, 60s, 70s. And he'd been a DJ at Northern Soul, Twisted Wheel and stuff like that. And he'd sort of settled in Matthew Street there, put this club on. And he had a very big influence over, I think, all the musicians at that time. Certainly me, you know, as just some kid who'd come in, and he'd trust me with a couple of his records, and he'd say, right, take these three home, don't scratch them, bring them back, I'll give you another three. So I kind of, you know, would hear all this stuff that I maybe wouldn't have otherwise heard, you know, which really changed. You know, it was sort of like that thing of the two things living alongside each other, like the new punk rock destroying everything, but then these fantastic, you know, old jazz or R&B or whatever sort of legendary things still kept alive, you know. So it was the two things at the same side of each other, you know.
Talking to Ian from Lightning Seeds, new album out. Where does the title, the name Lightning Seeds, come from?
It's from a Prince song where Raspberry Beret. But I don't think he says the lightning sees. I think he says the thunder hides what the lightning sees. But I just heard it as the lightning seeds, and I kind of just thought if it was a gang, I wouldn't have minded being in that gang.
So how do you all
form my own gang?
How do you all get together then?
Well, it was just myself really. So the idea was, I think when I was growing up. And I started producing a band called Echo and the Bunnymen, and there was a Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen. And I felt like those four guys in Echo and the Bunnymen, it was a very special chemistry. And I think the best groups are like that. The best groups are, you're very lucky if you happen to come across the four or five people that you just click with and make this special sound between you. And I kind of felt like that hadn't happened to me, and it just hadn't happened. So I thought, right, well, I'll do this, and it'll be like, you know, it can be an ever-changing thing of whatever I want it to be. The lightning seeds, it'll be whatever I want it to be that day. So it started off as me in the sort of top room of my house with a little 8-track, and I recorded the first album, Pure, and stuff like that. And then it kind of went on. I recorded the next album in my brother's house. That was, you know, move on. And then I got a little studio in town and did Jollification, which kind of then, you know, kind of led to me playing live and bringing musicians in to play live. I'm sort of off on that journey, so, and really I've just picked it up now. So it's, you know, I just originally thought I'd probably do three, it'd be three albums. I kind of have in my head I'll do three records, but then the third one was Jollification, and it sort of just led to playing live and led on to the next two. And then, as I say, I just reached a kind of a point where I think I just had enough, really, you know. And Three Lions sort of changed, made everything a bit different in a very positive, but at the same time, yin and yang kind of way, quite negative and positive at the same time. And it just felt like this feels a bit like, for now, an ending. And then when I started writing songs again for this album, I did a solo album of just no production, very kind of quiet album about 5 years ago, but this didn't feel like that. This felt like the songs were sounded bigger in my head than that. So it just felt like, oh well, I hadn't decided to make a Lightning Seeds album, it was just found I was making one, you know.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Quite amazing that you're celebrating over 40 years in the business. That's a career and a half, isn't it?
Can you believe that? I mean, that's 42, in fact, you know, because I've got my first big record was released to me. It came out January the 13th, 1967. So that's 42 years ago, isn't it?
Wow, that is an amazing track record. But you weren't always Engelbert Humperdinck, were you?
No, my real name is Arnold George Dorsey. Then when Gordon Mills changed my name in 1965, I didn't get a record till 1967, but he changed the name in 1965.
And where did the name come from?
It came from the... he was a composer of Hansel and Gretel, you know, there's only... But he wrote... Hansel and Gretel. Had one big hit.
Okay, great. Now, you always, growing up, was music part of your background, part of your family life?
You know what? I come from a family of 10 kids, you know, and I'm the only one that took up the musical side of it. My mother was quite musical. She played the violin and she had a terrific voice, you know, strong voice. So I think I get that from my mum.
Now, your career was nearly over before it started, wasn't it? Because you started out at... you were 17 when you first sang in public. And
yeah.
Then did it sort of come to a halt, the singing career, when you went into the military?
Yeah, it came to a halt right after that. I did my military service, you know, when I went in for 2 years into the British Army. And I came out, and after about a year or so, I got tuberculosis, and I thought my career was over, but God spared me, and I'm back on the road, and I'm strong as ever, and touring the world.
Brilliant. Now, you've been dubbed music's king of romance, and I'm reading that you've got an amazing three and one half octave range. That's incredible.
Say that again?
You've got a 3 1/2 octave range in your singing voice.
Yes, I have, yeah, thank God.
That's amazing. Yeah. And sold over 150 million records worldwide. That's quite an achievement.
Yes, it is. And I'm very lucky, actually, because, you know, I started at the right time and when the records were selling in the millions, you know. And you know, now you can sell 100,000 and be in the charts for, you know, a year. You know, but then you had to sell 1 million to get into the top five.
What's been the secret then, would you say, Engelbert? What sort of sustained your career over more than 40 years?
A lot of hard work, my friend. A lot of hard work trying to keep the... You have to keep up with the times and make sure that you're always on top of your job. And that's what I try to do. I try to give my audience the best of me at all times.
Any favourite songs in your repertoire?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I was very lucky with all the songs that I've recorded. I love them all. I've got some new stuff coming out. I've just recorded, my new album comes out about the same time as the tour. And my title song was written by Paul Anker and David Foster. And
that's a great combination.
Very good combination.
Two musical geniuses there.
Yeah.
Just reading as well, because you mentioned it earlier, of course, Release Me, that's the song that everybody knows, of course. It went to number one in 11 countries, I was reading, and it was so big in the United Kingdom. Managed to prevent the Beatles, very appropriate for Liverpool, two-sided hit, Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields Forever, from reaching the top of the charts.
Yes. Well, you know what, I couldn't believe that Release Me would stop the Beatles from going to number one, because that was going to be their 13th number one. But I don't think they're upset about it because they've sold millions of it. I was a big fan. I bought their record, so I was responsible for making them get there to number one.
And what's it like being on the road, Engelbert? Is it something that you enjoy, travelling around to different musical venues?
I love it. I really love it. You know, I've travelled the world several times to go to all these different countries. And, you know, and it's amazing. You know, you go to Korea or Japan, and China, and all the people sing along with you because they know your songs. It's unbelievable that, you know, a person from Leicester could have songs that are, you know, different nationalities know it and they sing along with you.
And do you have a loyal fan base following you around?
Yes, it's amazing. It's an amazing fan base. I have fan clubs all over the world, including all those different countries, you know, and it's fortunate that for me because it makes you feel at home when you get there. You know, they decorate your dressing rooms and they meet you at airports and things like that. You know, it's just a home from home feeling.
Now, I know you've received many awards during your long career, Engelbert. Just reading about the Georgie Award there from the American Guild of Variety Artists, putting you in the same league as the likes of Barbara Streisand and Barry Manilow.
Thank you. And, you know, the other day I was very lucky because the Variety Club of Great Britain gave me an award, like a Lifetime Achievement Award, and it was on the 24th of this month, and it was just wonderful. You know, it's all in good faith. You know, you're helping the kids along, you know, the disadvantaged children, and it all helps that, I think. And people in show business should do that if they can.
Well, it's certainly a great achievement and well-deserved, Engelbert. Any plans to retire, or is that something you would never even contemplate?
Any plans to retire, did you say?
Yeah.
What is that word?
Exactly.
What is that word? No. As long as the people out there want, I'll be there. I love singing, love being on stage, and that's what I want to do till my time is up.
And where are you based these days? Where are you living? Do you live in the States?
I have a home in America, yes, but I live on both sides. You know, I pop back and forth. It depends where I am. So, and now I'm at home now, and I love it, and it's just great.
And, of course, you are one of those artists who did crack that American market, didn't you, where a lot of people failed to do that?
Yeah, I was very in the early days, yes. Right from the get-go it was. You know, it went, released me, it was number one here, then it went to America, number one, and then it was number one around the world. And that's what gave me a global career immediately, and I thought, how fortunate of me to be able to do that.
And, of course, you played the big casinos in Vegas, didn't you?
Yes, I have. Yeah, many times, and I'm still doing it. In fact, you know, I play there about twice a year, and not for a long length of time, 4 days at a time, twice a year. Vegas has grown into a city of hotels, and it's jammed every time we go there. You know, it's not like it used to be in the old days when it was just five hotels and it was just a strip, and you got Vegas Row from all the dust flying. But now it's a big city.
Absolutely. Well, Engelbert Humperdinck, we look forward to welcoming you to Liverpool in September. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, and thank you to you and all your listeners.
My pleasure. That was Engelbert Humperdinck.
The City Cafe. City Cafe. City Talk 105.9.
You're listening to City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. Now, if you're a fan of Hell's Kitchen, you were probably surprised to see Bruce Grobbelaar throwing in the towel as he unexpectedly quit. He's joining me on the line now. Good afternoon, Bruce.
Good afternoon, Dean. How are you?
Yeah, a big surprise this. You were doing so well.
Yeah, I was doing well, but you must understand that it was a tough week with the Hillsborough Memorial and then Marco telling us that we had to make a dish from our childhood growing up, and you know, things got to you, and you're living in a box. You know, there's no outside, there's no windows for you to look outside from your bedroom window. There is just a box, and it's like rats in a cage.
Is it unrelenting then? Is it you know, a lot of pressure?
Well, listen, you can withstand pressure, but when it's like that, and the emotions get to you as well. And when you're there in the kitchen, you're working 24/7. You know, you got 2 hours in, 2 hours in the afternoon just to catch a quick nap, and then get changed for the evening service. But you're up at started off at 6:30, and we ended up getting up for about 7:38. It was my latest, and 9 o'clock you're straight in the kitchen. You're working.
Did they not explain sort of how grueling the situation was going to be?
Listen, we knew what the situation was from last year's episodes, so we could understand how it was. Just for us living in a commune, actually, it was grueling.
Now, you mentioned there that it was a particularly a trying week, especially, of course, missing the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough.
Absolutely, and the whole production team, Marco included, gave us from the 6 minutes past three for 2 minutes as a tribute and a silence. Everybody in the production team and the Health Kitchen fell silent, and they respected the time that had happened, and we stayed like that for 2 minutes. And there was no talking after the phone went again for the end of it for about another 5 minutes. And so they respected everything.
And fittingly so, of course. And then did the crunch time come, the crunch point come when you saw your family? Did they turn up unexpectedly?
Well, I knew my wife was going to be in there in Hell's Kitchen, and you kind of think, well, what is it about? Yes, it is about winning. Of course I'd like to win. But at the end, someone was going to get the chop. And I felt to myself that there were two young people in there that could learn a lot more if they stayed. You know, yes, I would have liked to have stayed, but the week got to me. And when I saw my wife out and she walked out of the restaurant, I said, no, my prize is out of this kitchen. She's walked out and I've got to go, and I'm going to go get it.
Well, it's a great sentiment to express that, you know, your prize was actually outside of the kitchen as opposed to inside. But while you were there, though, did you enjoy your time there?
Absolutely. If you'd asked me if I'd do that again, if it was a time, if it wasn't over the period that it was, I think I would have stayed there right until the end. But because it was that particular time, you know, over the Hillsborough period, I would do exactly the same as I did today.
But Bruce, that must have been a very difficult decision to make, you know, when you were considering going into Hell's Kitchen, knowing that the anniversary would fall while you were in there.
It was going to fall. It was a very quick decision.
Just breaking up a little bit there, Bruce. I'll just ask that question again, if I may.
It was very quick decision for me to go in. They wanted me to go in. I was supposed to have gone in the last Health Kitchen, but they gave the point to Jim Davison. So this year they asked me if I'd like to go in, and I said, no, I don't want to go in because I'm not a substitute for someone else. And they came back and they said, no, they really want me in. So I took it up.
And how was it working with Marco?
Marco looks a scary man. Yes, he can be, but...
Is his bark worse than his bite?
I think if he bites, he would hold on like a hyena. So don't get on that side of him. But if you do your jobs and do it properly, he's a very, very sound man. He's a complex character, but a genius. And it was great. It was a hell of an experience, you know, working with him.
And what about your fellow contestants, if I can put it like that? How did you get on with all of them?
Got on with all of them fine. It's, you know, apart from the young boy at the right in the beginning, you know, we all tried to help him, but he didn't want to listen. So obviously he was the first one to choose to go.
Isn't that sometimes the problem with the young? They think they know it all?
Well, yeah. If you want to put it that way, yes. He could have learnt so much more if he had stayed, and possibly he could have gone on to win it if he had just, you know, buttoned his lip and got down to graft. He could have gone all the way.
I'm talking to Bruce Grobbler, if you're just tuning into City Talk 105.9, who threw in the towel when he unexpectedly quit Hell's Kitchen. You got any favourites, Bruce, as to who you think might be in with a chance of carrying off the trophy?
Well, I'd like to see Linda Evans and Aid go through to the final, closely followed by Anthea. I think Anthea will stay there until the end. And I'm not saying that Naomi or Danielle won't be there, because they're all fine, fine people, and they've got merits in their own way. And they work very hard, you know, apart from slicing their fingers all every now and then, which is a hazard in the kitchen anyway. So, But they've all got fine qualities, and I didn't, you know, really don't mind who gets there to the final. But my instinct thing tells me that it'll be Aid and Linda being there at the end.
Now, we mentioned there that the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of Hillsborough fell in the week while, or just this past week, while you've been in Hell's Kitchen, and quite rightly so, Hell's Kitchen marked the tragedy with their own minute silence. But during that minute silence, it must have brought back some dreadful memories for you, Bruce.
It indeed did. We went in there at 6 minutes. We went in there at 3. At 6 minutes past 3, everybody fell silent. I wore the black armband the whole day and in the evening service. And yes, it did. It got to me a little bit.
And what was it actually like on the day for you? 20 years ago, it must have been.
Well, it's vivid in my memory. And to see people crushed against a fence is not the best thing for any goalkeeper. And I remember screaming at the person at the gate to open it, to release, you know, get some people out. And then looking again when the ball went in the back there, and then kicking the ball upfield, turning around, looking again. You see people getting handed to the top tier, you know, lifting them up. And then running toward the referee to let him know. That's vivid, and it will stay with me for the rest of my life. And for 20 years, you think that you can get over it, you don't.
Did you have any notion at the time, Bruce? Did you have any thoughts as to what exactly was going on?
When people are against the fence, screaming, begging you to help, you knew something was going on, but not to the scale that it was. It was only afterwards that we found out that there were, you know, dead bodies, and that was horrific in itself.
Now, there's been a call in the House of Commons for the papers that have the 30-year secrecy imposed on them to be released 10 years ahead of the time when they should be released. Do you think that they may shed some new light on exactly what did go on the day?
I would like those papers to come out today, yesterday, if they could have, because there's something in there that will shed light on the whole incident.
Do you think the 96 will ever get justice, Bruce?
I hope so, because with, you know, going through every single game you go to, and people, you know, they cry out for the justice for the 96. You think, well, what is it all about? You saw and you heard people, and I'm talking about people of authority and policemen, and getting monetary rewards or whatever it is called, compensation because of the stress level that they went through. They were only policing the place. What about the victims of the 96? They've never had anything like that. What about their sentiments and their feelings? You know, it's all okay. They're only football fans. Leave them alone. Excuse me. That is the club we're talking about. The club are the fans. The club's going to be there. The fans are going to be there long after people come and go from at Liverpool Football Club. The managers, directors, and everything. The club is still going to be there. And the fans are the ones that are the ones that are going to be there week in, week out. What about their, you know, their justice? And that makes me a little bit, you know, sick inside when you hear things that should have come out, and there are other papers that should be out. Get them out now. Let's sort it out. You know, why wait for another 10 years?
Bruce, the fight goes on. We are sorry that you came out of Hell's Kitchen. A lot of people here in Liverpool rooting for you, you know, betting on you to win.
Well, when I came out today, yes, you know, I got texts saying, yeah, I had some money on you. Well, they had some money on me. Well, that's only money, you know. People have feelings in there.
And when you get home, are you getting into the kitchen? Or are you putting your feet up?
I'll be getting into the kitchen, don't worry about that. But, you know, if you look back at it, it has been a great, great journey. You see, the thing is, once he sacks everybody, then it goes down to the public. But would I have won? I think maybe, but there were a lot of other fine people that a lot of people would be voting for.
Well, and the main thing was, of course, taking part. Bruce, it's been, as always, an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much indeed. And to the City listeners, all the very best. And please, never forget the 96.
Indeed. And as our friend, just to end on a lighter note, Bruce, if I may, as our friend Sue Johnson still says to this day, you've got the finest thighs in football.
Oh, did she now?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it's in print, believe you me. Bruce, nice talking to you.
Cheers, thank you very much.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.